ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously Fukushima-irradiated and fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's very nice, and everybody has a part-time job because of the extra UV radiation from the ozone layer hole as a incandescent light bulb. And my very special guest today is the wonderful, the illustrious, the fabulous, even, Paul Carruthers. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Vinny.
Okay. Now, we're here to talk about Alan Hubbard. And for those of you in the international audience who don't know, Alan Hubbard was a famed financier of the South Island. One of those kind of people that you would think of as one of those good men who would do a deal based on a handshake and expect that a man would keep it his word. And much like a lot of very good business people in this country and many others, those good people have their trust violated by scumbaggery individuals who want to take everything that they have. And precisely that happened to Alan Hubbard. Amid fanfare and much propaganda from the New Zealand government as well as the political left. And Paul was indeed the representative in a lot of ways for Alan's case, even though he was not one of the legal representatives. He was kind of, in a lot of ways, the public face. So, Paul, welcome.
Thanks. The thing with the Alan Hubbard story is that it's so complex that the majority of people have kind of tuned it out because they don't know. Most people won't devote the time to the issues involved to identify what it is that we're on about or why we're upset or how the public have been ripped off, how the taxpayers have been ripped off. Because the story was so convoluted and complex in the end that it's kind of understandable why most people don't understand it. But the bottom line is that that New Zealand taxpayers have been ripped off for more than $1 billion, right, by John Key and his mates. And the problem is for New Zealand is that the vast majority of New Zealanders just haven't connected the dots. You know, they haven't, they're too busy watching the America's Cup or whatever, which is understandable. But at the end of the day, the thing that concerns me is since Alan Hubbard died, we've had the Kim.com saga has blown up. We've had Solid Energy has collapsed and been shown to I'm absolutely convinced that company was stripped of
its assets. Apparently it wasn't so solid.
Exactly. You know, you've had a whole range of things have happened that indicate real shonkiness and wrongdoing on the part of this government and certain officials who are pulling the strings, and nobody's joining the dots. No, I'll give you an example. You haven't seen anybody in the media go back over the timeline and say, well, hang on a minute, John Key said Alan Hubbard was a fraud and therefore that justified using $1 billion of our taxpayer money, right, to sell all of his assets to parties that were related to Key and his mates at fire sale prices. The taxpayer basically had to subsidize the losses. So we had to pay out the banks the difference between what they sold those assets for, right, and what was owed on them to the banks. And Alan Hubbard got the blame for it, but the man never had a trial. Now, since that time, we've watched this whole thing with Kim.com, come into the media, exploded into the media. Everyone's got up in arms about it. It's led to all the GCSB hoo-ha, and everybody's now a lot more aware of just how dodgy John Key is. But nobody, including in the media, has gone back over this timeline and said, hang on a minute, why should we be trusting John Key on what he says about South Canterbury Finance and Alan Hubbard? Right. And that's the thing that concerns me is everybody's just sort of barged on forward and nobody's going back over it and saying, well, look, $1 billion is a lot of money for us to get ripped off by. Why aren't we questioning this? Mm-hmm. I mean, why is nobody questioning the fact, for instance, that they said they needed $1 billion of our money to subsidize the losses? That's the difference between what they sold the assets to their mates for and what they had, we as the taxpayer had to pay out the banks because of what was owing on them, right? Now, Alan Hubbard got the blame for all of that. You know, he's been described as the fraud. And interestingly enough, When he was under investigation, it was all about him. And then as soon as he died, I think about 2 or 3 weeks after he died, all the fraud charges suddenly got shifted across to the 5 other directors. But in the entire time that the investigation into Alan was going on, they never mentioned once anything about these other directors. So how did that happen? They never said these guys were under investigation or anything, and yet within weeks of Alan's death, all the charges, the fraud charges, was shifted sideways onto these guys, and absolutely nobody's questioning it. You guys have all just accepted that it was a finance company director, therefore he's a piece of scum, therefore he doesn't have any rights.
This happened after about 19 different finance companies collapsed, including, Hewlett Wealth Management, who was also co-signed by the National Party aficionado, what was his name, Don Brash, and John Banks. Mr. Hewlett, who actually went to jail because of it, but Don Brash and John Banks, who signed the same documents, didn't.
That's right. That's right. You know, the thing is that I don't want to put Kiwis down, but I will say this. New Zealanders, by and large, are financially illiterate, right? They do not understand how finance companies work. It's pretty straightforward, right? You deposit money with a finance company and they either loan it to other people, right, and get interest on that loan and give you a percentage of that interest as a dividend, right, or they buy an asset like a property and they wait for it to go up in value and that's how you get your dividend another way. The point is this, how a finance company collapses is really simple. Somebody, usually the ones that the money is loaned to, loaned from, for instance, a finance company will borrow money from banks and things like that to finance an asset. So they might put, say, $50,000 into buying a building. They'll borrow the other $50,000 from the bank. So if they start defaulting on those payments at any point, just like you, the bank can come along and say, right, we're going to take that asset back. Now, where it gets tricky is they appoint a third party to come along, like a valuer or something, and say, well, we think it's worth this much now. Now, the problem is there are no controls in New Zealand over who appoints those people or what their qualifications are or whether they have any conflicts of interest or not, and so it goes on. So the point is, in the case of South Canterbury Finance, the banks basically wanted to foreclose on the company and the government helped them do it. And they set Alan Hubbard up as the fall guy for it by describing him as a fraud so they could justify using your money, your taxpayer money, right, to pay out the banks on the difference between what the assets were sold for and what was owed to the banks. I'll give you an example.
Could I interject here? Let's say, for example, you were a ruthless criminal psycho and you had a lot of fingers in many pies around finance. And you saw somebody who was incredibly wealthy, who you thought wouldn't fight back, who was possibly a really easy target, who had an awful lot of money to take off you, and you had a good amount of influence in the media. So you make up something, like let's say he didn't issue a prospectus, when people like that never issue prospectuses on particular finance companies anyway. Then you go in, you get all your mates who are perhaps even working as that person's lawyer or what have you, so that you can split up all of those very, very lucrative assets at fire sale prices. You can scoop it all up for pennies on the dollar, and because you actually have a degree of control over the government and treasury, for example, you can then use taxpayer money to bail out the losses of somebody who wouldn't even make a loss if it wasn't for you stealing all of their stuff.
Absolutely. I'll give you an example. South Canterbury Finance owned a subdivision in Ashburton called Braybrook, right? This is one example of one asset that got sold out in the receivership where taxpayers got utterly ripped off and Alan Hubbard got the blame for it and nobody's asking questions. Now, the Braybrook subdivision was valued at between $6.4 and $8.5 million, right? Now, that means that the lowest valuation at $6.4 was based on a fire sale. They said, if you put it on the market, it'll probably be gone within 3 or 4 weeks and you'll get, at $6.4 million, someone will whip it up real fast. Alternatively, if you're prepared to sit on it for a few months and just see what happens, see which way the wind blows, you can get up to $7.5 to $8.5 million for it if you can bide your time. Now, the South Canterbury Finance owed the Westpac Bank $3.1 million on that property. So bear in mind that the bottom fire sale valuation that was done on it by the receivers was $6.4 million. So in Alan Hubbard's own words, it was a good asset, right? So in other words, if they sold it, rock bottom price at 6.5, they'd still walk away with more than $3 million and be able to pay the Westpac bank out. And that was the case in a lot of the South Canterbury Finance assets were actually solvent like that. They were good assets, right? They were right what they call low-hanging fruit on the tree. This was one example. Now, the receivers sold that subdivision. Now, let's understand this. This subdivision owed Westpac, South Canterbury Finance owed the Westpac Bank $3.1 million on the subdivision.
Who does all the government's banking?
Westpac Bank.
Oh, okay.
The lowest, Westpac Bank was the single biggest benefactor from the taxpayer-funded South Canterbury Finance bailout, right? Mm. Which is interesting because the minister, Simon Power, who made the decision to put South Canterbury Finance into receivership, actually left his job at the end of the last government term and became the head of private banking for Westpac Bank. So if that isn't a conflict of interest, I don't know what is.
Sounds like a minister for justice to me.
Yeah. So the point is that they owed South Canterbury Finance owed the Westpac Bank $3.1 million on this asset. They had the lowest valuation they'd received on it was $6.4 to $6.5 million. They sold it. The receivers sold it to parties who were known to them. Right, that's a related party transaction. Right, which they did not declare. Right, for $1.8 million. Now, there's no justification for that, and if you try and get, and I've got the paperwork, I've seen the paperwork, this is a fact, this is not a conspiracy theory, this is a fact. This subdivision was sold for $1.8 million. So you and me, the taxpayer, were told by John Key that because Alan Hubbard was guilty of fraud, we had to pull $2 million out of our, we had to pull what,
More like $5 million.
$1.5 million out of our pocket to subsidise the losses to Westpac Bank, right, to make sure Westpac Bank got their $3.1 million back while the receivers gave this property away at about one-fifth of its value, one-quarter of its value. And here's the thing. If you go to John Key and Bill English now and say, well, look, sorry, guys, it's not that we mean to mistrust you or anything, but it's just that this guy never had a trial, the guy that you've accused of fraud, because he died 3 days before he even got into a courtroom to prove himself innocent. Right. So it's not that we don't want to take your word for it. It's just that could we just have, I don't know, a little inquiry into South Canterbury Finance so we can just see for ourselves that you're telling us the truth. I mean, after all, John, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. Right. So, no, we can't have that inquiry, Bill English tells us, because the sale of the assets, the sales of all the assets is commercially sensitive. Well, Kiwis, how can you sit back and swallow that? If the sale of the assets is commercially sensitive, right, how come taxpayer money was used? If taxpayer money was used, your and my money was used to subsidise the losses, why aren't we entitled to know what those assets were sold for and, just as importantly, who they were sold to and, just as importantly, how much commission was made out of it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll give you another example of finance companies, nothing to do with South Canterbury Finance, of how the public just gets so ripped off by their own misunderstanding about how it all works, right? Bridgecorp. We all remember Rob Petrusevich and all those guys, the guys everybody loved to hate, right? Now, I'm not saying these guys were innocent. They were totally different case to Alan Hubbard.
What about for the international listeners, maybe bring them up to speed just quickly?
Bridgecorp is a finance company that collapsed owing $400-something million to mum and dad investors in New Zealand. And again, it was another case where the people that Bridgecorp's creditors basically foreclosed on it. Somebody came along and drew a line in the sand and said, well, you know, all the assets that you've borrowed money to buy here are all too leveraged. They're not worth what you owe on them. So we're going to call in the debt, basically. And this is the problem. You don't actually get to have any say. The investors never got to have any say in what the assets were valued at. And I'll give you one example. This is after Petrusevich and all those guys are in jail, and the receivers are still winding the company up and selling the assets, right? Petrusevich owned a boat called the Medici, right? Now, it was valued, when he bought it, he paid $1.5, $1.6 million for it. The boat was valued, fire sale, get rid of it, no questions asked, somewhere between $800 and $1 million, right? But say $1 million, sitting down at Westhaven, this thing, great big floating gin palace, right? Okay. The receivers sold that boat to a person that a friend of theirs, and that's been proven because a Herald article uncovered it. They sold that boat to a friend of theirs for $533,000, including GST, and they pocketed $257,000 in commission for themselves, which returned, what, $500,000+ to the investors. $250,000+ to the investors on a boat that was worth $1 million. And nobody asked any questions. So Rob Petricevich and his mates are in jail, and the receivers are basically giving away the assets scot-free to their mates. They're supposed to be helping the investors get their money back, and they're giving the lollies away to their mates at next to nothing, and nobody's asking any questions.
And we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Paul Carruthers is my very special guest for the next 2 hours. The caller line is open, 218-339-8525 is the number to call. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you go friggin' nuts! And my very special guest is Paul Carruthers. Now, we wanted to move on a little bit from South Canterbury finance and cover a big wide range of issues, because there's a lot of changes amidst the country right now, particularly change of leadership for Labor. There's some people talking about the very first Greens coalition-led government and so on and so forth. However, unfortunately, as far as I'm concerned, there's not a whole lot of change that we've really ever seen in this country based upon the political leadership strata. It all just seems to wind up benefiting the banks and the corporate scum that run and own the country in the first place anyway.
If any of you people out there are still caught up in this Labor national paradigm, this right-left paradigm, give it up. Right, just give it up, because it's never going to work. It's really frustrating watching all of these people. It appears to me that very few people want to take responsibility for their lives. What they want is somebody to make all the decisions so they can blame them when things don't go the way they want. And so what we do is we keep deifying these people and elevating them to positions, giving them credit that they haven't actually earned. And elevating them to positions that they're not actually suitable for, basically. David Cunliffe's a classic example. I mean, if anybody thinks you're going to get anything different with David Cunliffe running this country than what you get with John Key, you're absolutely dreaming. It's just not going to happen. Let me tell you a story about David Cunliffe, right? David Cunliffe came to Alan Hubbard's house, or in fact, he came to Alan Hubbard's doctor's house one day for a meeting that he arranged with Alan Hubbard so that he could come and get a whole lot of paperwork to take away and try and embarrass John Key in Parliament with, right? Now, that was in the very early days of the investigation into Alan Hubbard. Now, I had set up a database of Alan Hubbard's investors where I had around about 225 or so of them on an email database so that I could keep them in touch with what was going on, because in our campaign to lobby the government to get justice for Alan and to, you know, draw attention to what John Key and his mates were doing with the South Canterbury Finance and all the assets, we ran up over 7,000 emails lobbying the government. So we had Alan Hubbard's investors involved in that all the way along, on an email list. Now, I sent an email to those investors that night and said, David Cunliffe's just been to Alan Hubbard's place, has just met with Alan Hubbard and taken away a whole lot of paperwork, so good news, he's going to stand up in Parliament apparently and have a bit of a go. The next morning, when I was driving back from Timaru to Christchurch, my car phone went and it was David Cunliffe, and he was angry as, and he had a go at me on the phone for daring to mention his name in an email to Alan Hubbard's investors. And I asked him why he was upset. And all he was worried about was that John Key was going to get hold of the fact, or the National Party was going to get hold of the fact that he that Cunliffe had been to visit Alan Hubbard, and they were going to embarrass him in Parliament with it. So no regard for the fact that $1 billion of your and my money was going up in smoke in the process. No regard for the fact that the investigations into Alan Hubbard were unlawful, and David Cunliffe knew it and didn't want to do a thing about it, right? It was all about appearance, right? Everything David Cunliffe is doing is about appearance. It's about how it appears to you in spite of what's actually going on. So if you genuinely believe, right, that you're going to get a different or better outcome with David Cunliffe running the Labor Party than you have with John Key running the National Party in control of this country, you are absolutely deluded. I can absolutely promise you, because I've witnessed firsthand how that guy operates, and he is a flake, right?
I was thinking about the connections here. So we've got John Key is the MP of Helensville, southwest, and he lives in Parnell, which is one of the swankiest suburbs in central Auckland. And then you have David Cunliffe, who's the MP of Newlyn, which is out west, and he lives in Herne Bay, one of the swankiest central suburbs in Auckland. And people think that a Harvard-educated man is somehow in charge of a party that's all for the poor working man.
Yeah, you people have been had. You just got to look at the voting record within Labor. Look at it. Look, within Labor, the own caucus, this is the people who work with these guys every day. Hardly anybody supported David Cunliffe, right? The only ones who did support him, if you look at their profiles, they're all clinging on by their fingernails, basically. That none of them actually do anything that's worthwhile. They'd all be out of Parliament a long time ago if people really knew how much they didn't do. The ones who really, probably what I would describe as the better MPs and the more seasoned ones all supported Grant Robertson. So what does that tell you, right? These people actually work with these two guys. And hardly any of them supported David Cunliffe. Where Cunliffe got his support was from the unions and the people outside the Labor Party hierarchy. That's the ordinary people out on the streets. And I'll tell you why it happened, because you had people like Duncan Garner and all the other media, high-profile media people pushing for Cunliffe. Oh, you know, all the rhetoric, oh, New Zealand's not ready for a gay prime minister. Well, everyone I spoke to said wouldn't make any difference to them, but you had all these high-profile people saying New Zealand's not ready for a gay prime minister, New Zealand's not ready for this, New Zealand's not ready for that. Dave, it's going to have to be David Cunliffe.
Who decides what New Zealanders are ready for? The media, apparently.
That's right, and it's just like the way the National Party won the last election, right? They had everybody in the media, all the big noters and the big voices, just shouting everybody else down and telling everybody. It should actually be illegal for anybody in the mainstream media to go on national television or national radio, right, before an election, within a certain time period leading up to election, and say something like, it's a foregone conclusion, National's going to win it, end of story, don't bother thinking anything else. They shouldn't be allowed to do that. What's the point in having elections if you're going to have all these people pushing this agenda like there's no tomorrow? I mean, it's different to politicians actually standing up and saying, here's my policies, this is what I stand for. That's not the same thing. But when you get the likes of Paul Holmes and Paul Henry and all these other tossers, the Duncan Garners of this world, right, using their public platforms to go, I support National and you're an idiot if you don't, right, or, you know, New Zealand's not ready for a gay prime minister. You know, it has to be Cunliffe because it's a fait accompli. We've got no choice in the matter.
At the same time, most of those guys work for MediaWorks, whose former CEO is now the communications minister for National, who brokered a deal to bail them out $30 million in unpaid broadcasting license fees and gave the prime minister an hour of time to speak to the public, called the Prime Minister's Hour, in the height of election season when it was illegal to do that if he was talking about politics.
Yep.
But they said, oh, he's not going to talk about politics. He's going to talk about Coronation Street and his cat as the Prime Minister of New Zealand.
There's too many people turning a blind eye to the rules being broken left, right and centre on the way the media operates in this country. And the media has become almost like a slot machine, you know, like you push a button and it just does something you want. It's become like a slot machine for political parties. And
it's almost like a fortune teller that you give money to and they read your palm and tell you what they want to hear.
Yeah, vote for this or vote for this party or you'll die. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like, yeah.
So what I'm saying is that everything, you know, the agenda that they want to happen just keeps getting pushed, insidiously pushed in your face. And you end up sitting there going, oh, well, you know, maybe what's the point fighting it? Because everybody else appears to be talking the same way and thinking the same way, so I'll just go along with it, you know? And this is how it happens. I mean, I don't think it should have been a foregone conclusion that David Cunliffe ended up leading the Labour Party. I honestly don't.
It was for me, because I just saw him. He's the only person with a high enough public profile to basically make it that wasn't had that high profile because he bought porn on his credit card.
Well, no, that was Shane Jones.
I know.
Okay. That's true, actually, now you put it that way. But, I mean, here's the point. When you got the likes of Duncan Garner and Martin Bradbury, who I just, God, a man just gives me brain damage. I can't stand him. But Martin Bradbury and those guys, they're out there pushing it constantly. They're trying to convince you that this whole paradigm of left or right, Labour versus National, that somehow if you support one over the other, you'll get a better outcome in your own life. They're deluding you. Those people are dreaming. It's not going to happen. It hasn't happened in how many decades? What makes you think it's going to happen now, right?
What's changed? What's now so radically different with the country that the two mainstream parties have lied consistently and totally betrayed the country every single time that they elected? What's so radically different now? The answer is freaking nothing.
I tell you who's starting a political party in this country that's worth watching, Kim.com.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you why. Wait until you see the policies he brings out. Anyone who knows anything about what's good for this country would support him straight away on his stated intention around the IMF for a start. He's already hinted, I've seen it on Facebook, he's already hinted that he wants to take New Zealand down the same road as Iceland and Hungary. And if he does that, I'll back him 110,000%. I'll be out there with a megaphone supporting the man because it is the right thing to do for this country. David Cunliffe is working for the same bankers that John Key basically answers to. So why you would think that you are going to get a different outcome is just beyond me. I mean, I think that's why Shearer gave up, because I think he had a crisis of conscience. I think he knew. I think David Shearer is actually probably a decent guy who just figured out in the end that he couldn't win no matter how hard he tried.
Did you hear about his promotion of mercenary forces in Northern Africa while he was working at the UN?
No. I mean, I'm happy to be wrong about him. What?
Yeah, see, when he was in the UN, he titled a big report, a document. There's a whole lot of sort of what they call politically unstable regions in Northern Africa, Sudan, Nigeria, so on and so forth. There's a lot of US and foreign interests that are in there. But in order to send your army in there, it would be really politically risky, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So Shearer was the author of a document encouraging the use of private mercenary forces in order to settle the West's conflicts in places where it would be a little bit politically risky to send in their own troops.
Right. Okay. So he's obviously not that.
see, it's the problem. That's why I call the universe fractal scumbaggery, because it's a repeating pattern. For every instance of scumbaggery that you look into, there's a whole new world of scumbaggery that comes into light. And then each one, a little bit of that you look into, a whole new world comes to light.
Yeah.
And it's a real problem with this country is that we have a media that doesn't interview people, say, like yourself, for example, in long form. I was watching the news last night, Paul, and I saw these protesters outside protesting against deep sea oil and so on and so forth. And I was just thinking to myself, you know how much airtime they actually gave somebody time to express their views? It was about 4.5 seconds.
Yeah.
They got time to have one sentence.
Yeah.
You have any idea how much information you can cram into a single sentence?
Yeah.
Frack all.
Yeah. I mean, this is what happens when you watch the mainstream news, basically. What they do is they tell the story the way they want you to hear it and they want you to understand it. And then they get somebody to either, basically they just get somebody to 4.5 seconds to provide the proof that everything they just said to you is right, okay? And it just goes on and on and on, and nobody asks any questions. I'll give you another example about Cunliffe, right, of how people just get, how people become myopic, you know, just blinkered to the point where they don't see what's really going on. David Cunliffe was the Labour, I think, finance associate minister or something. Finance spokesperson or something under the last Labour government. Or he had a finance. He was involved with the finance portfolio somehow. The bottom line is, dozens and dozens of finance company finance companies collapsed on Labor's watch prior to John Key getting into power in 2008, right? Now, it was totally unregulated. The New Zealand market was virtually unregulated. The Companies Office never did anything to stop it. The Securities Commission was completely useless. None of them actually did anything to control or regulate finance companies. They all just took a completely passive approach. So there's dozens of finance companies just tipped over on David Cunliffe's watch, right? And then John Key comes in and says, don't worry, New Zealand, I'm going to save you from all these bad finance company people.
I used to work at one called the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, I'm going to save you from people like me, you know what I mean? And I'm going to use your money to do it, and you're going to love me for it, and you're going to thank me. You're going to thank me for sticking it to this 84-year-old man who's getting dialysis because he's the archenemy of New Zealand. He ran this finance company, right, that I have to use your money to bail out now because of his fraud. And we don't have to worry about little details like, oh, I don't know, a fair and proper investigation into him. I mean, you know, we'll just announce that he's a fraud before we even start the investigation. And because you people are also desperate to hang a finance company director, any finance company director, you'll swallow it hook, line and sinker and you won't ask any questions. And guess what, New Zealand public? That's exactly what you did. I mean,
and they did thank him for it as well. I go out protesting and stuff like that, like on Pukekohe, and have people wind down their windows. There's only one thing I've got to say about John Key, mate. Thank you. Like, seriously.
Yeah. You know, this is the thing, is that your sort of gut need to hang a finance company director, John Key needed you people to be angry with all these finance company directors so you'd turn a blind eye to the way he was doing it. I mean, none of you ever asked, like, how can they accuse someone of fraud before they've even started the investigation, right? I mean,
why do you think they use the Serious Fraud Office, mate? Because they're the ones that run most of the serious frauds.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was really interesting hearing one of Alan Hubbard's lawyers describing the guy that ran the Serious Fraud Office what did he describe as an arrogant little git? I had a real giggle over that. But the thing is that you people have been completely and utterly diddled because your own need to hate somebody has been manipulated and played on.
Mm. Well, you know what they say, you can keep everybody afraid, and all of a sudden their reasoning process and their ability to question and clicks off, and you can get them to do whatever you want. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Paul Carruthers is my guest.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around
welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. You know, it's interesting. What was his name? Bob Dylan said the times they are changing, and unfortunately, the regime and control of New Zealand, i.e., the bankers, that ain't. All right, Paul Carruthers is my very special guest. Now, we've talked about the Labour leaders, we've talked about the Alan Hubbard debacle. Where would you like to go next, or would you like to stay on this kind of leadership thing?
Yeah, I do, because I want to talk about how I'll give you an example of how Cunliffe, how I don't think you can expect anything different out of him. So this guy went to Alan Hubbard's house and then basically, you know, tried to get information that he thought he might be able to hang John Key in Parliament with, but then had a complete meltdown and a panic attack when I notified Alan Hubbard's investors that he'd done that. Because I asked him, I said, what are you worried about, David? You can imagine I'm driving along, right, I was on Bluetooth, but I was driving along in my car, got David Cunliffe having a go at me down the phone, and I'm going, David, what's your problem? What are you worried about? Why are you so worried that I told Alan Hubbard's investors you went there and got some information and that you're going to stand up for them in Parliament? And he said, oh, because National can get hold of the information and embarrass me with it. Well, what's more important to you, you know?
Well, hold on a second. They're going to embarrass you for seeking out information to hang them with.
Yeah, like here he was there getting information that absolutely, it's been proven in several ways that investigation was unlawful. David Cunliffe knows it. He's been given all of the evidence on a plate, right? David Cunliffe knows the investigations were unlawful. He knows the receivership was a scam. He knows that parties related to the receivers and the decision makers have benefited materially from it at taxpayers' expense. He knows we can't get an inquiry into it because John Key and Bill English are playing secret squirrel. He knows that He knows that they're using terminology like, oh, well, it's the sale of the assets were commercially sensitive. So, you know, even though your taxpayer money was used, it was commercially sensitive. We can't declare who we sold it to or for how much or how much money was lost or what we had to pay out the bank with your money. We can't get any of that information, and yet taxpayer money was used. And have you seen David Cunliffe stand up once and challenge any of this? No. So why do you think he's going to be any better or different? Now, I've heard all the stories from the Martin Bradburys and people like that saying, oh, you know, Alan Hubbard was a fraud, he was Mr. Magoo, you know, trust David Cunliffe, you know, he nobody could stop what was happening, Alan Hubbard was as guilty as sin, and, you know, don't listen to that pork or others, he's an idiot. Well, Alan Hubbard never had a trial. So what Martin Bradbury and David Cunliffe and the rest of them are asking you to do is to basically turn a blind eye to the fact that the justice system was completely left out of this equation.
It was missing in action.
It was completely missing in action. What they're all saying is you've just got to take our word for it that Alan Hubbard was guilty and therefore $1 billion of your money was needed. Now, what I'm saying is I am lumping David Cunliffe in right in there with John Key in terms of liability and culpability for this, and I'll tell you the reason why. Because David Cunliffe has got the power to stop it. David Cunliffe always had the power to stop it, and David Cunliffe never exercised the power to stop it, right? So he's as guilty as you are, and I can absolutely guarantee you he knows enough of the fine details about this subject, right, to know that he could finish John Key by next week with it. And why isn't he doing it?
I smell blackmail.
Yep, no, he's not. I'll tell you why he's not doing it, because he knows that John Key can turn around in Parliament and say, ah, yes, David, but something like 24 finance companies collapsed on your watch. You left us with no choice, right, but to have to step in and act. And guess what? All the no-brain, no-thinkers, all the people with the 4.5-second bloody attention spans out there, what they're going to do is go, yeah, John's right. We needed to be saved from one of these finance company directors, and it doesn't matter if the process was all dodgy about the way they went about it. At the end of the day,
it doesn't matter whether all the money went to John Key and his mates.
Yeah, it doesn't. At the end of the day, Alan Hubbard, old, sick, who cares? We just wanted somebody to go down. So we're not gonna argue with John Key about it. We're not gonna question David Cunliffe about it. We're just gonna accept that it needed to happen. Well,
think about the morality standard. You know, you're going after an elderly man who's on kidney dialysis. Just that by itself.
Yep. I mean, nobody questioned. I got into it because he was 84 years old and getting dialysis. I'm like, what's wrong with you people? The guy's sick. The way a society treats its elderly people and its young people is an indication of where we're at. And I'd say, based on all the evidence I've seen, we're screwed.
I reckon they were probably hoping he'd die of his illness before he'd ever have the chance to fight back.
Alan was due in court 3 days after he was killed, less than 3 days, actually 2.5 days after he was killed. He was due in court to submit all of his evidence to challenge all of the government's actions against him. Now, I know what was in his evidence, and I'll tell you now, that was 5 weeks before the last election, and the evidence that was going to be submitted in court would have found its way into the newspapers the same day, and if that evidence didn't stop the government from winning the last election, it would have severely damaged their chances. They would have certainly lost seats over it, because the evidence was overwhelming that the investigations were unlawful and that the government had effectively lied to the New Zealand public, completely misled the New Zealand public. Now, David Cunliffe knows this and he's done nothing about it, right? So they're all guilty of misleading you. I'll absolutely guarantee you that. And if I'm wrong, then I would be happy to be proven wrong by a full judicial inquiry into the South Canterbury Finance Receivership. But what I'm not willing to accept is anybody, David Cunliffe, John Key, or Bill English, or any of their supporters on any side, trying to tell me that there shouldn't be an inquiry, or that it doesn't matter that proper process was dispensed with, or that the justice system was completely trashed in this process because it was a finance company director, right? The minute we start going down that road, it's a slippery slope we can't return from, because then what we're doing is we're just hanging people out to dry by media trial. I mean, Judith Collins is very good at it, right? She just litigates everything by media.
So is Paula Bennett.
You know, I'll give an example with the way they do things. David Bain. David Bain spent 13 years in jail. He's effectively been on trial for 20. If you look at the way we carry on in the newspapers and on Facebook and on television, David Bain has effectively been on trial for 20 years. Of those 20 years, he spent 13 of them in jail. But that's not enough for some people, right? They've still got to hang the guy. So when Judith Collins gets presented with an opportunity to offer this guy compensation, or with the question of whether we should offer him compensation or not, she just hangs it out in the media and basically starts a whole new trial. So we're now into, what, the 21st or 22nd year of David Bain's ongoing trial, thanks to a justice minister that actually doesn't want to do her job. And that's the way things are going in this country. What they're doing is they're using the media. When I say there, I'm meaning the political parties. They're using the media to litigate subjects in the public forum that actually belong before the courts. Then what you're finding in this country is that everything that does go to court usually goes against the government. Kim.com's a classic case, right? If Alan Hubbard had gone to court, the whole outcome would have been different. The public would have been alerted to the fact that this whole South Canterbury finance receivership was a scam. But he was killed 3 days before he got to court in a car accident. He wasn't killed in a car accident. He died of a heart attack 2.5 hours after the car accident. But the car accident was the means by which he was put in the position where he lost his life, was the best way I could describe it.
Yeah, well, he was apparently he was laughing and joking with the nurses or whatever. Look, and then they bung him in a helicopter that's like a couple of minutes ride to the hospital that he's going to, and he dies on that ride.
A couple
of days before he's meant to go in court to destroy the national government 5 weeks before the election. Isn't that freaking convenient?
I mean, half of you people would have watched the other driver on Campbell Live several weeks ago, the guy that hit them. There he was on Campbell Live and nobody joined the dots. He said, oh, yeah, I thought it was a bit strange. Yeah, they wheeled him past on the trolley on his way to the helicopter, and he told me, and I had a bit of a chat to him, and he seemed perfectly fine to me. I mean, his widow told me the same thing. Oh, yeah, the last I saw him, they wheeled him past me on the trolley, and he said, oh, they're taking me to Dunedin. And she said to him, oh, well, I'm going there in an ambulance, so I'll see you in a few hours. Oh, yeah, okay, see you later. Half an hour later, he's dead. I mean, no, of a heart attack. And yet, whenever you pick up a newspaper, whenever you read a newspaper, Fairfax is really good at it. They'll say, Alan Hubbard died in a car accident. Alan Hubbard died in a car accident. Alan Hubbard died in a car accident. Every time you read a newspaper, he did not die in a car accident, mm-hmm. right? He was injured in a car accident, but he was laughing and chatting to all of the staff for up to 2 hours after the car accident, and he died of a heart attack when he was airlifted in the helicopter to Dunedin Hospital for surgery. Now,
it's come out in the U.S. Congress. I don't want to get all conspiratorial here, but it does happen that the CIA and DARPA and a number of other agencies have developed weapons that they can use to actually cause heart attacks and be completely undetectable, untraceable. So it's not outside the realms of possibility. I'm not saying that's what happened. But these kind of things happen all the time. Look, intelligence agencies are very ruthless, and they act on behalf of whoever's corrupt. In my experience, you take the unions, for example, the people who kind of voted for David Cunliffe to be the next leader of the Labour Party. I've spoken to a number of former union leaders, and they say that the whole dang structure of them have been completely infiltrated by intel ops and so on and so forth. So there's a whole bunch of complicated things going on here, and the fact that it stinks to high heaven and is highly suspicious, I think, is enough.
I think that, I think what propelled David Cunliffe to the lead of the Labour Party was all the help he got from the Duncan Garners and the Martin Bradburys and all these people that are busy trying to help.
That's all of the above.
Yeah, I mean, all these people are just misleading the public, basically, but there's nothing, I mean, they've got the broadcasting power, you can't stop them. I mean, it's up to you, you people out there, to exercise your individual choice. And exercise, discretion and common sense, and do your research. But look, I'll give you an example, another example of how you've been totally scammed with the South Canterbury Finance Receivership. Now, I'll tell you what, this is a bit complex, so we'll do it after the break, because this is actually really important. I can give you stuff to Google for those of you that care. Go and Google it, and it will prove me right. I will show you exactly the degree to which you were scammed and exactly how you were scammed, and you can Google it very quickly and easily.
All right, we'll get into that after the break. Kyle in Philly, I can see you're on the hold there. The call-in number is 218-339-8525. We'll take your calls after the break. Back in a minute. Ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show, the show from which you cannot escape because we will find you. And my very special guest is Paul Carruthers. Why is that music still playing? Come on, AFR, get on the Johnny with the spot and turn that puppy down. Like, any time would be good, preferably right about now. No? Okay, that's nice. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on in the studio, ladies and gentlemen, that is beyond control at this point. A lot of problems and so on and so forth, including a board op who has to take phone calls to the network at the same time as run the boards themselves. So let's just listen to the music for just a few minutes until he comes back and turns it down. It is so complicated. There we go. Okay, and now welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so you had a whole bunch of stuff that you wanted people to Google. Should we take the call off before you finish your thought or after?
Take it before.
All right. Kyle in Philly, you're on the air.
Hello, guys. How you doing? Sorry, I'm having difficulty hearing you. You're very low. But I wanted to comment about what you were talking about earlier, speaking about the not giving a trial because they're a financial institution, and secondly, having all the facts and basically a trial by public public appearance or whatever. And if a trial isn't instituted, there isn't a trial, then what's that setting a precedent for? That's setting a precedent for different classes and different laws for different people and organizations and what have you. It's saying, you know, if you die down the street, do a crime, then guess what? We're going to throw the book at you. But if you are in this special group or in this special percentile, then the laws don't apply to you. And once you have that, there is no sense of any sort of government or fairness or whatsoever. So it is... Even if they're exonerated, even if they're proven to be 100% innocent, there still needs to be a trial.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, the whole reason why I stood up for this guy was because I was more interested in defending the integrity of the justice system, right, than him. I wasn't defending him. I was defending the integrity of the justice system and trying to explain to people why it's so important that we protect the integrity of the justice system. It's a very finely balanced thing. The minute you allow a politician or anybody with broadcasting power to stand up and point the finger at somebody and say that person is guilty of whatever, right? And they use the media, that's newspapers and television, to do it without allowing that the person they're accusing access to a courtroom to defend themselves, you're in trouble. Because what you're doing is you're playing to people's base emotions, right? You're effectively using the mob, you're using mob rule to you're basically delivering the justice system into the hands of the mob, and the mob are being easily influenced and manipulated. They're having their strings, their emotional strings, pulled by the players who are doing the finger pointing, and that's precisely what happened here in New Zealand. And it was an absolute disgrace. It was a travesty of justice. It should never, ever, ever have been allowed to happen. And the people I'm most disappointed with are not the people who actually did the finger pointing or the politicians that ripped everybody off with it. It's the general public who turned a blind eye to it. It's the people who turn up to Anzac Dawn parades and put their hand on their heart and pretend that they care about all the lives that were lost, defending those very rights that we are now happy to watch being trashed and sold down the river by all these idiots who are doing finger-pointing and using the media. What they're doing is they're treating the justice system. The justice system has become a popularity contest, and it cannot be allowed to happen because people's basic protections go out the toilet. All of a sudden then, all it takes is for a politician to stand up and point at a sector of society we don't like beneficiaries or welfare beneficiaries or something like that, and all of a sudden people are happy to watch the complete abolition of those people's rights because somebody said that it was more important that we focus on X, Y, Z instead.
Kind of like Guantanamo Bay, you know? I mean, you haven't had no trial or anything like that, so we're going to give you sensory deprivation and do mind control experiments on you. It doesn't matter.
Yep. So, you know, the New Zealand public need to wake up and start actively participating in the justice system in the process of ensuring that justice actually is applied properly and that it's applied evenly and fairly to all people, because that is not happening.
Funnily enough, one of the people who was trying to actually do that exact thing, named Vince Seymour, fighting for a greater court transparency in New Zealand, was jailed for 6 weeks recently because of that.
Yep.
Well, yeah. And moreover, facts are not facts, especially in the media. Things can be portrayed any way they want to be portrayed. A truth can be turned into a falsehood. A falsehood can be turned into a truth. And at least in a court of law, although it may appear to be boring to some people, and it might not be, you know, Nancy Grace out there with headline news or whatever, even though it might consider be boring or mundane, at least it's correct. And at least you're hearing two sides of the story. And it's presenting the facts the way that they want to present it, but you're hearing both the arguments. Now, on a media station, on TV, news, print, whatever, things can be skewed beyond belief.
Yeah, they can. Yep, yep, there's no doubt about that. And it's happening on a daily, well, not a daily basis, but it's certainly happening on a regular basis in New Zealand. So, you know, the thing is, it's up to the public to educate and inform themselves. It's up to people to say, okay, you know what, I'm not gonna live my life chasing the next sensation and only paying attention to anything that I can fit within my four and a half second attention span. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, that's the reason why these guys are getting away with it, because people are just asleep. They're sleepwalking their way through life and accepting everything they're being told. If you know, the problem at the moment is the ones who are winning are the ones who've got the money to have they got the money to throw at producing the loudest voice. Well, right, the biggest headlines and the loudest voice wins the argument now, regardless of whether it's right or fair or reasonable.
They have the ability to put in front of the population what they want in front of the population. If you want to know the truth, you have to do your own digging. You have to do your own research. You have to get out there on the internet or in the public or wherever and speak out.
Before you can do any of that, though, Kyle, one step deeper than that that absolutely needs to happen? It's the breeding ground for the change that we want to come. And I'll tell you what it is. People have to develop an appetite for the truth.
Mm.
People don't have an appetite for the truth, right? And particularly in a country like New Zealand where, you know, speaking up against the deference to authority in this country is so ingrained in society that it's disturbing. It's really, really quite alarming, because you've got politicians getting into power who know that people won't question stuff, and they're milking it for everything it's worth. They know that for every one person that stands up and says, hang on a minute, I'm going to question this, there'll be 10 that'll come along and knock them on, bang them on the head and go, shut up, don't ask questions. Don't rock the boat. Don't make the rest of us look like we're troublemakers. And that's the problem.
The people who have benefited most from this system, the people who have the wealth and the people who have the power and the people who have attained status, have the least motivation to want to change the system and change the way things are. The ones who are living in poverty, who are suffering under oppression, whose voices aren't being heard, are the ones who want change. But by the same token, they also have the least amount of power. There needs to be a way to get those who have the ability to present on a large platform or sink large amounts of money into the truth. There has to be motivation for them to do that. What that motivation is, it's got to be a united front on the lower level. It's got to be an idea of, hey, listen, if you're not going to present what we want to see, if you're not going to present the truth, if you're not going to allow us to have what we need, then I'm sorry, but, you know, we're going to vote with our dollar. We're not going to support you. We're going to picket you. We're going to use what little power we do have unitedly against you.
Well, New Zealand has got, I mean, we are, the potential for change is in the wind here, because what we've got is something unique that the rest of the, that doesn't, isn't happening anywhere else in the rest of the world at the moment, and that's Kim.com. And he's announced that he wants to launch a political party in New Zealand, and he's got the financial clout to do it. He's certainly got the publishing power now, the broadcasting power.
I was wondering about that, actually. Didn't he have all his assets and all his finances and everything frozen by the GCSB and all of those scum?
Look, I get really hot under the collar about this, and I'm going to say this to New Zealanders. How the hell, right, can we sit back and allow John Key to use your taxpayer money and my taxpayer money to hang a New Zealand resident or a citizen, doesn't really matter, Kim.com, out to dry, right? This case is a case of US corporate interests, right, being allowed to use the New Zealand... John Key has assisted US corporate interests by using the New Zealand police as a private army to assist those US corporate interests, and he's using the New Zealand justice system, right, to assist those US corporate interests to persecute a guy in a case that is being described to the New Zealand public as a criminal matter, when in fact, in the worst case scenario, it should only ever have been a civil case.
Yeah.
It's a civil case. It's a US corporate interest trying to protect the income of artists, right? That's what this is about. Well, that's what they say they're trying to do, protect the income of artists. Well, if that's the case, then by all means, take a civil case against Kim.com in a US court and let the guy defend himself outside of the criminal system.
Don't invade his house with 70 cops, 2 choppers, 16 cars, and raid through the place when the day before you already sent a copper who got given a grand tour of the place.
Whoever used New Zealand tax, $1 of New Zealand, whoever authorised the expenditure of even $1 of New Zealand taxpayer money on this wild goose chase, right, which effectively is to help US corporate interests, right? And how they've got away with it so far is they're trying to convince the public that it's a criminal matter. It's not a criminal matter. It is absolute corruption and misuse of Zealand taxpayer money. Authorised it should be in jail.
If that's the case, Paul, then it is a criminal matter, except it's not Kim.com that's the criminal.
The criminal is whoever has authorised the use of New Zealand taxpayer money. I mean, you had the head of state services describing the guy that runs the GCSB as an outstanding civil servant. Well, the guy's had to apologise to Kim.com, and he's wasted something like, it's in the tens of millions of New Zealand dollars now, taxpayer money, basically fighting Kim.com in court over this because Kim.com's rights were completely trashed. And that's what we do. And then the government describes that to us as outstanding civil service.
At the same time, when he gives the okay to illegally surveil 88 political activists in New Zealand who have broken no law whatsoever, completely illegally, and has no charges of any kind brought against them.
The whole thing's a scam.
the whole thing. You know, this is the difficulty that we're talking about. Kyle's hung up now. I think that this country, just like every single other country, this is the same thing going on in the United States. This is one global syndicate mafia of scum that are working against freedom and human and the human race as a whole.
New Zealand, I'll tell you one thing I'll say to New Zealanders is this, right? There's this real thing in this country of you look at you. It's really nice that most of you want to give other people credit. You know, it's a nice thing. It comes from a good place, and I understand all of that. But the problem is it's called suspension of disbelief. It's like when you're presented with evidence that pure scumbaggery has gone along, the problem is that most people then go, no, they couldn't be that bad. Oh, no, John Key wouldn't be that bad. But David Cunliffe's so much nicer than John Key, he wouldn't be that bad. And this is the problem you get. Those people know you think like that, and they're milking it for everything it's worth. Wake up, right?
We've become so dumbed down, so complacent. I was just talking to a mate of mine yesterday about the America's Cup, bro, and I was just like, you know why people don't wake up to the New World Order is because they're plugged into the America's Cup, they're plugged into the World Cup and so on and so forth. When the World Cup festival of rugby came here, it was right in the middle of an election season. And guess what? Right at that election, we had the lowest voter turnout since 1886 when even women weren't able to vote.
I'll give an example.
I think that's a mistake.
You watch Facebook now. If we win the America's Cup, watch what happens. Because if we win it this weekend, it'll be timed with John Key's visit to Balmoral and the Queen, and it'll all be hyped up in the media. And you watch what they'll do. I'll guarantee you this. Somehow or another, as if by magic, the media will sort of morph the winning the America's Cup into John Key's visit with the Queen. And then what'll happen is all of his supporters will go, oh, yeah, John Key, the Queen, America's Cup, all at the same time, yeah, New Zealand, yeah. They'll morph it all together, and John Key will be infused. People will infuse this guy with all these magical powers, and they'll somehow equate John Key visiting the Queen to us winning the America's Cup. And it will just go on and on and on. And nobody will actually think about the facts, which are completely unrelated issues, right? But you watch what happens. You'll actually watch people morph these two issues together and turn it into some kind of magical story that actually doesn't have any basis in reality.
Yeah. John Key is New Zealand now. Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
He's like our dear leader.
Yeah. I mean, the media have him. They're very clever. They have him on every day solving a little problem. Oh, but John Key says that's not going to happen, so we're all safe now. John Key says, don't worry, if that happens, we're going to step in and do this. So, oh, that's all right, we're all safe again, now we can relax. And they do this on a daily basis. You end up to the point where a lot of people think we can't live without him.
30 seconds. Yeah, I do think that we can live without him, and we survived for a very long time before he came onto the scene. Apart from the fact that we had the late 80s stock market crash, where he made a huge killing selling off of our currency, which in no small part actually contributed to our currency collapse. We'll be right back after the break with Paul Carruthers, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you go anywhere.
Gay. Did you know that Key?
Oh, we will. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the most operatic 2 hours in talk radio. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, 5 days a week, and with the music that never stops for some reason. Come on, guys, we've got to get that Shiite Muslim together. Welcome back, everybody. My very special guest is Paul Carruthers. Now, you know, something about finance receivership that you wanted to get out of the way we were talking about over the break?
We've gone all over the place and covered a whole lot of things in this show, but I want to go back to the South Canterbury finance issue, right? To those of you who are interested in it, right? If you've got a pen, if you've got a pen handy, right, I can give you some links, or I can give you some words, keywords to search for in Google that will get this information, the information I'm about to tell you, it'll get it in front of you, right? First of all, let me explain the background of what I'm saying, and then I'll tell you what to Google, and it will all make sense to you, right? When the government put South Canterbury Finance into receivership, right up until the night before they put it in receivership on the 31st of on the 30 yeah the 31st of August 2010, mm. yep, 31st of August 2010, they announced that they were putting into receivership. But right up until that point, all the way through the media, they used the media to continue this ongoing speculation as to whether or not they were going to put it into receivership. It was that they were portraying it as not a foregone conclusion, right? It was still being decided on the last day. And I know that for a fact because Alan Hubbard sat up until 2:37 a.m. the morning before it was put into receivership with his advisors trying to get Treasury to accept his offer to solve all the problems and recapitalise it. And Treasury would not accept, the paperwork that they were offering across the desk. So they were forced to have to go back to their offices and email it to Treasury so they could get an electronic receipt to prove that it had been accepted. That's how hard Bill English and John Key tried to stop Alan Hubbard from resolving the situation, right? Now, this was the day before it was put in receivership. So you had all the media speculating as to whether or not it was going to need to be put into receivership, and the government was keep playing its cards close to its chest, and they weren't willing to say whether it was a foregone conclusion or not. And there was all the appearance of scrambling last-minute activity trying to salvage this company, right, and stop the potential for taxpayers being exposed to a $1 billion bailout, right? Well, what I can prove to you is this. Go and get a pen and write this down and Google it. Corda Mentha, that's K-O-R-D-A-M-E-N-T-H-A, that's two words, Corda Mentha Treasury, Corda Mentha Treasury, South Canterbury Finance Receivership. If you Google those words, Corda Mentha Treasury, South Canterbury Finance Receivership, what you'll get is a range of links that come up in the first sort of 10 Google things that come up, you'll get links. If you look at those carefully, very, very carefully, don't just look at the documents, but look at the links, look at the URLs from Treasury. These are Treasury documents that were made out, and those URLs show the date that those documents, right, were written up and put into Treasury's archives. And what you have, bearing in mind that on the 30th and the 31st of August 2010, the government and the media were still playing the game that it wasn't a foregone conclusion. We're trying everything we can to save this company. It's not a foregone conclusion. It's put in receivership. If you Google those words, you will find that the links will show you that on the 16th of August 2010, the government appointed Corda Mentha as a receiver of South Canterbury Finance. On the 17th, that's the day after they appointed Corda Mentha receiver, on the 17th of August 2010, that Treasury, that's the government, asked Corda Mentha, they basically commissioned them in writing with a contract. They said, we will pay you to write a report describing the state of South Canterbury Finance. On the 26th of August 2010, that's 9 days after they were commissioned to write their report, Corda Mentha submitted their report to Treasury, and it's all there in the links if you Google it. And that report said, oh, South Canterbury Finance is basically buggered, and yep, Alan Hubbard's buggered it up, and yep, they owe all this money to all these people and they can't pay it back, right? So that's still a week before they actually put it into receivership when they were telling you that none of this was a foregone conclusion. What's wrong with this picture? If that isn't the evidence that you've been scammed, I don't know what is. They actually appointed the receiver before they even made the case for receivership, right? And then they got Corda Mentha to write the case supporting the receivership after the fact, right? And then Corda Mentha produced that report in less than 9 days. How do you do that with a company that's got 30,000 investors and $2 billion of market capitalization? How do you do that? How do you write a report in 9 days, less than 9 days from scratch, even doing an investigation, unless you're basically just making it up as you go along?
That was what I was going to say. There's only two ways that you could possibly do that. Number one, if you're making it all up, Number two, if he'd been doing it for a long time previously, just waiting for the hammer to drop.
If South Canterbury Finance was the corner dairy, right, I'd understand that they got this report out in sort of seven. I mean, of those 9 days, one of the, or two of the, there was at least one or two weekends in there, right? And you can guarantee none of those guys will work weekends. So you know, the point is, how did they do that? If it was a small business, I'd understand it, but that was a huge and complex business requiring $1 billion of taxpayer money to bail it out. How did they produce a report in less than 7 days? So it's not possible.
These kind of things take months and months and months to do. Usually like 4, 5, 6 months.
And here's the thing. Who is Corda Mentha? Corda Mentha is a receiver and an insolvency practitioner. Who owns Corda Mentha? Michael Stiassny. Who's Michael Stiassny? One of John Key's best mates. So how does this work? Well, Corda Mentha was the company that the government got to write the report describing Solid Energy as buggered, right? So that justified the government stripping the whole thing and leaving the taxpayer to carry the losses, basically. Corda Mentha. Who was the Crayfer Cut Farms receiver? Corda Mentha, right? Who's the TV3 receiver? Corda Mentha, right? Who was the South Canterbury Finance receiver? Corda Mentha. The list goes on. So every time the government or John Key wants something to look a certain way in the media, he just gets Corda Mentha to write a report about it. And they either say it's buggered or it's great. One example of how they described something was great was Sky City. Who wrote the report saying that the deal for the Sky City deal was good for New Zealanders? Who commissioned Corda Mentha to write the report saying Sky City was good for the government? John Key, right? And who wrote the report? Corda Mentha. So Solid Energy, Sky City, South Canterbury Finance, Crayfer Farms, TV3 receivership, it's all Corda Mentha. What's wrong with this picture? If that isn't evidence of cronyism, what is?
You're thinking about one receivership company that basically takes every single high-profile receivership case in this country who has direct personal links to the current government. That is some backroom deals going on. That is some sideways money changing hands. That is the very definition of corruption.
So now, question I've got for you, all you people out there that support David Cunliffe and the likes and the idiots like Martin Bradbury, is where the hell has David Cunliffe been throughout all of this? Have you heard a word from him about it? Does he operate in a vacuum, right? Does he not have any... Does he not privy to any of this information? I mean, if I've managed to figure all this crap out sitting at home, Googling it on my laptop, what's David Cunliffe been doing for the hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money that we're paying him, right? Is this guy deaf, dumb and blind, or is he only able to see and hear the things that he wants to see and hear? This stuff is huge. It's really important to New Zealand voters.
This is like the shadow government.
And they're totally asleep on it. So my question for you, Martin Bradbury, for your lover boy, David Cunliffe, right, is where have you been all this time, guys? Where have you been? Why aren't you raising any of these issues, right? You guys cherry-pick the issues that you want to kick up a stink about because it's all strategically done to look a certain way to everybody. You're all on the bloody take, right? If David Cunliffe gave a toss about corruption and in New Zealand, and if he gave a toss about what really matters to taxpayers, he'd have challenged John Key on every single one of these issues. And where has he been? Silent.
And talking about that recently, he's just been saying, oh, it's crony capitalism because you're not taking away any of the fishing rights for the commercial fisheries while taking it away from the game. I mean, it's like you talk about, you know, like the tiniest. Have you heard of the term Johnny come lately and Johnny come not too frickin' much?
I mean, what are the public saying, really? What are they saying? Oh, well, we don't really care if you rip us blind for $1 billion here and there. We don't even care if you're dishonest. Just make sure we're allowed to catch fish. You know, I mean, wake up, people. What's really important?
Yeah.
These people are absolutely rorting you with your own money, and you're all sitting there going, David Cunliffe will save us? Well, guess what? He hasn't yet, so what makes you think he's going to?
Yeah, it's like the Cancer Society. How long they've been running, 25, 30 years or whatever? How many cancer cures they come up with? None. If you were a builder and I went up to you and said, okay, how long have you been a builder for? Oh, like 30 years. How many things have you built? Nothing. Well, do you think that the cost is full of crap or whatever? And that's precisely the same kind of methodology that we're working at here with these politicians. They're in the game. They've been in the game for a long time, had massive alleged failure, maybe even it was deliberate, like after one after the other, and still nobody has any clue because they're all compressed into a soundbite. You cannot get this kind of information compressed into a time frame that short. New Zealanders need to develop a much longer attention span
you
in
do.
Order to
you
get
do.
This kind of information in there.
Your problem is, most of the people out there, is you don't want to think. What you want is someone else to do all the thinking for you. You just want to elevate someone to a position to take, you know, to do all the talking and do all the thinking and then report back to you in sort of something that takes about that long so that you can easily digest it and not have to think and then just tune into your next sensation like the America's Cup or something. That's what's allowing you to be ripped blind. You need to start analysing this stuff more carefully and thinking more critically, right? Start thinking. Stop elevating other people to positions they haven't earned to do all of your thinking for you, right? They get exposed to bankers and oil companies who offer them big fat bribes to sort of say nothing and do nothing and report back to you what they want you to see, and they just all end up on the take, right? Probably the only MPs at the moment in Parliament who aren't really on the take would be the odd Labour MP and probably a fair chunk of the Green MPs, and that'd be about it if you're lucky. Mm. That's why I'm supporting Kim.com. Because he's just a fresh wave of energy without those agendas. And why is he going to side with the very people? Why is he going to take bribes from the very people who've been busy trying to
destroy him
for the last little while, right? Mm-hmm. He's going to wipe every single one of them off the plate, and that's exactly what needs to happen for this country.
We need somebody who's been painfully discriminated against at the hands of the corrupt scum that run this country in order to fight back against them in a public manner. You can't have somebody who's always been, you know, perfectly happy, living the high life, living in Herne Bay, Parnell, or whatever, who has never really suffered at the hands of the establishment to try and change it.
I mean, I've been described as a conspiracy theorist and a nutter and all sorts of other stuff for defending Alan Hubbard and for digging as deeply into this issue as I have. But I'll tell you this, I'm no fool. 8 years ago, I hit the road traveling around New Zealand to help build a company from scratch. And that company ended up with 1,500 customers around New Zealand. It turned over $130 million last year. And I was one of three people that helped build it. So I'm no fool. I can tell you, I know what I'm talking about. I know how business works, right? And I'm telling you now, you're being had, and the, how you're being had by Key and Cunliffe and all of their mates are that you don't want to think about stuff. You just want to elevate them to some kind of godlike status to do all the thinking for you, and you're being completely and utterly taken for a ride. So if you want this country to start heading in the right direction, stop buying into those kind of games and those kind of tactics and start thinking for yourselves. Right? Go inside of yourself, figure out what you really value in life, what really matters the most, and anchor that in and act from that and speak from that. The reason why you're all getting blown around like leaves in the stream, you're getting thrown around like leaves in the stream, basically, by events, is because none of you, very few of you really know what matters. You don't really know what matters to you most. Right? You have to figure out get clear about what really matters. What really matters is a sense of community. What really matters is that we treat each other with compassion and empathy and fairness, right? And respect. What really matters is that respect is a right. It's not something people should have to earn. If you give it to people by right, they will reflect it back to you. If we're all busy making everyone earn their respect, you end up with a society full of people who are just angry and hate each other. And that's effectively what we have at the moment. That's the perfect breeding ground for the likes of John Key and that to come in and just divide the whole lot of you and turn you against each other. And that's exactly what's happening.
Right. Paul Carruthers is my very special guest, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll be right back after the break.
Not many, if any, not many, if any. How many dudes you know got the skills to go and rock a show like this? I don't know anybody. Check, check to the mic, check. A 1-2 from a crew coming through. Are you hype yet? Nowadays, everybody wanna talk, but we got someone to scribe. Ain't got nothing when I'm up in the live. It came from when you're feeling the vibe. You know, scribe is taking me high. Level with the double bass, vibration, the place in your vertebrae. Y'all hear the man move like an RS. Super rude with the crew, come equipped like a body kit. Lyrically, vibe burn quick. So one foot is missed out to his tongue like a stale fish. This skin ain't aches when the vic when it get described. You live like an 05. I got a vibe like a beehive. But when the mother from the square to the pier by the seaside, I get y'all know the way that we ride around town on the down low. Never know what the flow pro drop, drop. Can't stop hip hop cause it don't stop. Check it out. Check it out. Check it out. Check it out.
What problems? Fucking ever stop me. Come on, come on, AFR. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Okay, there we go. Finally. All right, now we've got about 10 minutes to wrap up, Paul, and we've talked about a lot of important issues here. I mean, like, in my opinion, the whole of New Zealand, every single one of us, we've got 4 million residents, 1 million overseas, there's 5 million New Zealand citizens, give or take, worldwide. They all need to have listened to this one particular show, as well as many others, of course, but this one in particular, because of just the length and breadth of the discussion and the exposure of the copious quantities of scumbaggery and corporate corruption that is going on in this country that really subverts every single process that we hold dear as New Zealanders.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, actually, on a technical issue, just one technical issue going back for the, anybody who's been following the South Canterbury Finance story, the Alan Hubbard story, right, who's been following my you know, story, how I've been telling the story all the way through this, there is one point for those of you, you know, the one or two of you out there who really care about this issue. There is one point that I think you should know. There's often what I came up against when I was trying to alert people to what was going on is that I kept arriving at the same point, right, where people would say to me, yes, we understand you're really defending this guy, we understand all of this, but at the end of the day, he had really high-powered lawyers and they never said a word and we haven't heard from them, so if he was that innocent, how come his lawyers didn't say anything? Well, I always wondered the same thing myself. I know that they billed him and his wife for more than $6 million, right, in fees for defending them, but even though they never issued one word in their defence in the public forum. I recently discovered about 3 weeks ago through another source that it turns out that they were actually – it's possible that his lawyers were representing Treasury, were working for Treasury at the same time they were working for Alan Hubbard. Now, I don't know if that's a fact and I'm not accusing his lawyers of that, but what I am saying is I know for a fact from Alan Hubbard's own widow herself that she has she actually went to visit Treasury one day because she was asked to sign some papers. And when she was walking out of the lobby of Treasury, she was very surprised to come across one of their lawyers. And she expressed her surprise to him at finding him there. And he admitted to her that they actually did work for Treasury from time to time. And she went home and basically expressed to me and the other people around her her surprise that that wasn't declared to her. So just about 3 days ago, I did an Official Information Act request to Treasury to find out if their lawyers had actually done any work for Treasury in the time that Alan Hubbard, between when he was put into statutory management and when he died. I've done an Official Information Act request to determine whether or not his own lawyers did any work for Treasury in that time, because if they did and they didn't declare it to their client, I think you'll find that's your answer. So for those of you who've ever wondered why didn't Alan Hubbard's lawyers say anything, I'm saying to you that I've done an Official Information Act request to see if there's dots to connect there. I will let you know via Vinny what the outcome of that was when I get the answer in about 20 days. But it's safe to say what I can absolutely guarantee you is if they come back and say, yes, Alan Hubbard's lawyers also did work for Treasury, I can absolutely guarantee you that they did not declare that to their client. I know that for a fact. So that sweeps that one out of the way.
Mm. I don't know what to do about this situation. I mean, let's say if we look at the facts here and just be assumptive about it. Let's operate on the assumptions. We assume that those who are elected officials are liars and crooks. Let's assume that the bureaucrats who actually enforce the will of these liars and crooks are also themselves liars and crooks. Let's say that the courts are corrupt. Let's say that the police themselves are derelict in their duties. What can we do about it? And I just come back to the same point. And it's a point that you raised earlier, is that we're always elevating other people to say, oh, it's their job, it's not my job, I've got to do this, that, and the other. And I think the reason why I quit my job is because I realize that this job that I'm doing right now is a frackload more important, because if I don't do this job that I'm doing now, this very important work, there won't be a country for me. There won't be employment for me. There will be nothing. I won't own any. I won't be able to have any custody over my own children. I won't be able to have the ability to have a job that won't just be taken away from me. I won't have any rights. I won't have any due process. I won't have anything. I will be a slave, lock, stock, and barrel, long before I ever make enough money to live a comfortable lifestyle, if I don't expose this entire corrupt system and get it overturned.
Well, you've identified what really matters to you in life, and you're living it out, basically. You're following your heart and acting out of your own convictions. And that's what I'm suggesting that people do. You know, I mean, I understand there's a bit of it sounds like contradicting when I'm saying, well, I'm going to support Kim.com if he starts a new political party, when I'm saying, you know, you shouldn't be deifying and putting on pedestals people like Cunliffe and Key and all the rest of it, when it looks like I'm doing the same thing. If Kim.com comes out and starts that whole sort of vote for me and I'll solve all your problems carry on like the other clowns do, then he's going to lose me. I'll tell you that right now. But if he comes out with what I suspect he's going to do, which is what I would do, which is to show people how to empower themselves. Any good politician would teach you to fish, right? Not convince you that they can provide you with the daily quota, right? Any politician who basically tries to convince you they can solve all your problems is lying to you. They are lying to you, right? Any politician who sets up a bunch of initiatives to help you solve your own problems is your best friend. That is the person you should be voting for, right? You should be giving your support to people who are helping you support yourself, right? And that's the paradigm that needs to shift. That's what needs to happen in order for us to start progressing forward as a more inclusive and richer society. And when I say richer, I'm not just talking about rich in material terms. John Key is perfect for all the people. He's the perfect leader for people for whom money is everything, right? If you value people in terms of their material worth alone, right, you're a poor. You are a poor, poor individual. You are poor in spirit. You're very poor. You're poverty stricken in spirit. That's all I can say.
Let's just say worthless.
Yeah. You know, I mean, some of the best rhetoric I've seen about this issue comes out of the Green Party. I'm not necessarily a Green supporter, but I do like some of the things they say. We shouldn't be measuring this nation's richness in material terms alone.
Did you hear what Russell Norman said the other day, that tax is not a burden?
Yeah.
That's freaking nuts.
Yeah. It's, I mean, New Zealand should have a much lower tax rate than it does for a start, so people are encouraged to spend and save. It's just absolutely absurd the way we've got it set. It's actually, there's a disincentive to succeed and run a business in this country. There really is. So, you know, what I'm saying is, take responsibility for your own thinking. Take responsibility for your own critical analysis of situations. Don't just take Martin Bradbury's word for it. If you follow that man, he'll just lead you off a cliff, right? I can tell you that right now.
He's a member of the Fabian Society. The symbol of the Fabian Society is a wolf in sheep's clothing. And a wolf is still a wolf, even if he ain't eaten your sheep yet.
I mean, those guys just, mate, they're only interested in being the centre of attention, right? They're not even interested in whether what they're saying has any value for you or not, as long as you're paying attention to them, basically. And that's not necessarily good for you. What's good for you out there is to think for yourself, act for yourself, decide for yourself, right? What really matters to you and what you're going to do about, what do you want to do about the situations we're currently facing in this country? How can you participate? What part can you play? Are you just going to passively sit back and keep elevating other people to positions they don't actually, they either aren't qualified for or they're too corrupt for you to trust them to have so that they can make all the decisions and then you can sort of sit back for a while and watch how it goes and then decide, nah, this isn't going the way I want, so we're just going to basically tear you off that pedestal that I put you on in the first place and tear you to shreds and go and find someone else to put on a pedestal and make all the decisions for me. I mean, when are we going to learn?
Every time you put somebody on a pedestal, as soon as that person falls below your expectations, they fall off that pedestal and you're the one that gets crushed as a result because you put them up there, didn't you?
Yeah. The most, you know, I mean, the thing is, every single one of you is the leader of this country. Every single one of you has the power to make a positive difference in your own life and in the society around you. But I see very few people actually claiming that power. I see a hell of a lot of people basically believing that they don't have any power, they don't have that power, and desperately looking for someone else they can give that power to in order to make all the decisions for them. Right, you have to break out of that paradigm if we're ever going to hope to have the kind of society that most of you all seem to claim to want when I look at the way people carry on Facebook.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for coming into the studio today. And ladies and gentlemen, bear in mind, there is no saviour, okay? If you're looking for a saviour...
You're it.
That's right. Look in the mirror. And if you're looking for the cause of all the country's problem, you have to look in the same direction. You are both the saviour and your own destroyer. Realise the power that you have to do the good rather than the bad. Paul, Absolutely. Thank you very much. And we'll see you again sometime, folks.